Being involved in elite sport takes commitment, perseverance and skill. With a greater expectation of athletes to perform at exceptional levels, the demand on match officials and referees has never been greater. The View from the Middle podcast series is aimed at telling the stories of those people who have undertaken this unique and demanding task. This series enables an insight into what life is like for a match official in the elite national and international sporting arenas. So welcome to the View from the Middle podcast. Here's your host, Grant Atkins.
This week's View from the Middle podcast guest is Queensland-based soccer referee Jared Gillette. With 119 A-League games to his name and referee of the year for three seasons, Gillette continues to be one of the leading officials in the round ball game. Hi Jared, welcome to the View from the Middle podcast.
G'day Grant, thanks mate, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no problem. We'll quickly start. You've obviously had a long road to becoming a professional referee. How did that road begin?
Yeah, I started quite young. I began as a referee whilst I was still a player, probably like most of us originally played the game and never really set out to become a referee to begin with. I was a player at Mudrabar Soccer Club on the Gold Coast, and my dad was heavily involved as a coach and within the club, and our whole junior team had to sit the entrance exam to become referees. So I did that with the rest of my teammates at that time, and I just started refereeing junior football whilst I still played for a bit of pocket money either side of the game that I was actually playing in, and found that I enjoyed it. And I guess once I discovered that my playing ability was potentially never going to reach any great heights, and I sort of stuck at it, and like most football codes, had the opportunity to go to a few junior tournaments and I guess get on the pathway towards some more higher games and things like that. But I played a few other sports as a kid. I played baseball for about 10 years, and then I was sort of heavily involved as a golfer for a few years. So, I'd play 18 holes in the morning at my club, and then get mum or dad to drive me, to the football field and referee a couple of games in the afternoon. So I was still involved in other sports. And then it wasn't till, I guess, around 17, 18 that I sort of started taking it a bit more seriously and realising that, there was potentially a bit of a career path there for me to follow.
Hmm. Do you remember as a junior referee finding it really difficult to come back each year?
It wasn't so much difficult to come back each year. It had its moments, in every year as a junior referee, especially learning and still developing as a referee. But then secondly, things like your resilience and self-confidence and I guess belief in yourself that you're doing the right thing. I certainly had had moments after games as difficult as probably all match officials have, but I never really questioned my I guess drive or ability to keep refereeing. It never really entered my mind to stop at any point.
So the A-League have gone to full-time referees at the moment. What improvements have you seen in the officiating since that's occurred?
Yeah, you're right. I've been lucky enough to be one of the first three guys that FFA have put on as a full-time refs. So we started in late 2015, and I think the benefits for the three of us have been really tangible, and especially when it comes to managing life from the international side of things as well, which is something that we have to deal with. Obviously, being a world game, we're part of Asia now, and a lot of our international games are in Asia, which involves a lot of travel, and essentially holding down a full-time job is just about impossible. Yep. To perform at the level that we need to. So from a practical point of view, it's made it a lot easier and made life a lot easier to just balance everything else in your life. We could be refereeing in Iran or Saudi Arabia on a Tuesday and then be back refereeing on the A-League on a Saturday or a Sunday. And if you've got to squeeze in Thursday, Friday at work, if you're a school teacher or whatever the case is, it's really difficult. So from that point of view, it's helped immensely. Secondly, just our physical preparation and training has improved. And I think that just goes hand in hand with having the time during your day to dedicate to that. So instead of working your 8 hours and training in the evening, we can obviously dedicate a large chunk of our day to more specific preparation. You know, we do a lot more football-based strength and conditioning stuff, a lot more specific, I guess, training skills as opposed to, I guess, the old school aerobic running and, I guess, rock up for your hour session on a Tuesday and a Thursday. So they're probably the two biggest aspects would be being able to manage things a lot easier and a lot better. Secondly, the ability to, I guess, commit and focus and just have a bit more time to prepare as best we can. And then, I guess, thirdly on the back of that is the recovery, which, again, you know, we're potentially obviously coming back from games in Perth, Wellington, and then overseas. Having to jump off a 14-hour flight, get in the car and drive to work isn't ideal from a recovery point of view. So we have the time to actually do that now. And the benefits of that, hopefully longer term, we can stay in the game for a bit longer and I guess stick around for a few more years than we previously potentially couldn't.
So you touched there on some of the physical preparation that you do. There's two other aspects I'd like to ask you about. What kind of mental prep do you do going into games, particularly, well, let's start with domestic games firstly, but then obviously games that are occurring overseas, and you mentioned places like Iran and Asia.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I guess firstly, to touch on the mental prep domestically, we do a lot of work now on the tactical awareness of how teams play. And I think it's an area that we've focused more on in recent times. And it really came to prominence after about the 2002 World Cup, where the referee for that final, Kalina, who's quite a well-known referee, basically locked himself in his room for days before the World Cup final and studied the teams and the way they played. And he got to the game and there was no surprises for him. He knew exactly what he was going to face. So we do a lot of work, around the playing styles and team tactics and how that affects our positioning and movement. Certain, you know, I guess ways that certain teams play will influence where we have to be to try and get a decision right. The second aspect of that is we've been doing some work with a guy called Warren Kenno, who has actually been doing a lot of work on our individual, I guess, mental skills, if you like, around just understanding our personalities a bit better and getting to know ourselves a bit better and how that might actually influence what we do on the field of play. So, you know, really delving deeper into the sorts of things that might trigger us off to I guess, lose our composure or take us away from our natural state where we referee well under pressure. And I think that's been really beneficial.
What are some of the challenges you've had officiating overseas?
The biggest one is actually the physical challenge. You know, some of the toughest environments that we officiate in physically are in countries like Saudi Arabia, where I remember a match, I think it was 44 degrees at 8 o'clock at night, and that's around kickoff time, and it's just a completely different beast physically, and then how that affects you mentally as well. So, you know, that's probably the biggest challenge is, I guess, having to adapt to the different conditions and perform at a level that you know, is required as an international referee. That would be the biggest challenge.
What kind of preparation would you do for somewhere like Saudi Arabia in terms of when you turn up or when you arrive in the country?
We have to to arrive 2 days before kickoff, which that actually doesn't give us much time to acclimatise at all. If you speak to most of the sports science guys, they'll tell you that's nowhere near enough time to try and adapt to the conditions. So it's basically all about feeling as best you can for kickoff, to perform as best you can, and things like adjusting your sleep cycles, nutrition, making sure you're taking enough food that you can actually eat if you're somewhere where you know you're not going to be able to eat the local food. We'll normally try and squeeze a gym session in on the day we get there. So 2 days before the game, we'll have a light run at the stadium a day before the game, and then referee the match, and we're often flying out the morning after the match. So there's not a lot of time to adapt or really train according to the conditions once we're there. It's just managing things as best as you possibly can to physically and more so mentally be in the best shape for kickoff. And I guess understanding that we're not going to feel great after a 14-hour flight and getting off into that temperature, and that's probably just understanding that that's going to be normal and just managing it as best we can.
Do you find much, or do you find it difficult to officiate, obviously, teams where there's a language barrier?
Yes and no. It can be a benefit sometimes that, you know, you don't have to engage in long dialogue, and football refereeing, I guess the language is quite universal and the body language is universal, and it can actually work in your favour sometimes. You obviously can't use the little one-liners that you could probably run past a player and potentially say something that might influence his behaviour positively. So from that point of view, yeah, it's difficult, but at the same time, I guess players that potentially can't speak English as well are probably less likely to try and engage in long dialogue and try and influence you. So that's a positive.
Do you find it difficult with other match officials from around the world when they have the language barrier?
Yeah, that's quite a challenge. And in recent times, AFC try to appoint us as a trio. So when we travel, we'll often travel with the referee and our two assistant referees. Oftentimes even a fourth official. So I'm off to Korea on Sunday for an Asian Champions League match, and there's four of us from Australia going. So that makes things a lot easier, just, you know, not just on the field, but as well as off the field, our training habits and sleep and meal times and everything like that we can manage. But there's oftentimes still now where, yeah, you'll have an assistant from another country. And it is a challenge, because often they'll have their own little nuances and their own slightly different interpretation, and that's really important in the 2 days before the game to try and get yourselves in balance and on the same page as best you can.
Is there much networking done between, obviously, the referees from the A-League and the FFA and other associations across the world?
Yeah, we often get a FIFA instructor out to conduct our annual seminar. I guess as FFA, obviously fall under FIFA and AFC, and all of our, you know, interpretations and guidance on the laws of the game and how we're interpreting things come from the top down. So I guess more recently, the best example of that is the introduction of the video assistant referee that we've had in the A-League recently, where that's come from IFAB and FIFA, and obviously we're part of the trial. It's a worldwide trial, but every year the international referees from all over Asia meet in Kuala Lumpur for an annual seminar. AFC are often conducting workshops for professional development, things like that. So, and that's a good opportunity for all the refs from the different countries to get together and discuss challenges and some common issues that we all face.
So with the video assistant referee, you're obviously involved in the initial game that was involved, where it occurred in over in New Zealand. What level of research was done into the effective use of that technology prior to its implementation a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, you're right. I was in the hot seat for the first decision using the VAR. We've actually been training to implement it since about September last year. So we've undergone a comprehensive, I guess, training program to get to this point to be able to go live. We have conducted trials both offline, so at A-League matches where we've actually, you know, practiced the protocol and things like that without actually talking to the referee. And we've also done a number of games where we just practice matches where we were actually live hooked up to the video assistant referee, and the players would deliberately do things that we could intervene and practice the actual protocol of changing a decision, because it's not natural, I guess, for us to make a decision, and then just the mechanics of actually how do we get to the point of reviewing it and then ultimately changing it. We needed to practice that whole process. So yeah, it's been a real eye opener, and I think, you know, we've so far there's been 10 A-League matches since it's been introduced live, and that's the only decision so far that's been changed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you guys discussed much about how you're going to deal with on field when your decision's overturned?
Yeah, we have, and IFAB set some guidance around how we deal with certain situations, like players who draw the TV screen, for example, asking us to review a decision. I think in the early stages, especially in these initial 15 games that we're going live with, we're trying to show some common sense to give players a chance to adapt. And I think ultimately it should lead to less dissent and less questioning of our decisions, because the players will know that automatically a penalty decision is checked anyway.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't get to the point of an official review, then it's not clearly wrong.
Yeah.
But to have the confidence that every single penalty decision is automatically being checked, it should give, I guess, some comfort to both players and referees that there's actually no need to protest, there's no need to dissent, because it's being checked anyway, is the way we're approaching it.
So in relation to a decision being overturned or what is a perceived error, what kind of strategies do you have or you've utilised in your career so far where you probably realise that the decision made in real time is probably the incorrect one? Whether that feedback come from the players or from the fans or possibly a replay, what techniques have you used to move on from those decisions in a game to ensure you officiate effectively from then onwards?
Yeah, great question. And I guess initially, just to finish on the VAR stuff, the ability now for a decision to be corrected at the time, I think, is the biggest benefit of this VAR system, in that spectators, players, coaches, everybody is able to actually move on at the time. We don't have to I guess, live with that potentially for a long time after the match without the ability to change it. So I think that's the biggest positive. In terms of some strategies that I have used and do use in terms of decision-making on the field, I guess at the time when we make decisions, we're making decisions because, you know, we've seen something and we trust ourselves and we trust our gut and we give it. And ultimately, there's nothing really we can do afterwards without the use of some sort of technology that might be able to change that. So for me, I guess it's just having the belief and the trust to trust what you see and trust your gut and give it. And it's the times when you don't do that, when you don't trust yourself, often we regret it when we look back on an incident and think, I actually should have done that, or I didn't do it, but my gut said I should have done it. It's very rarely is it the opposite, where we do things and we look back and they were wrong. So I think part of that is accepting that sometimes we're going to make mistakes. We don't set out to make mistakes, but the acceptance that sometimes mistakes happen. And I guess at the time, though, if you can only trust what you see at the time with the information available. And then in hindsight, we can look back at a potential mistake and potentially identify some learning areas to come out of it and hopefully not make the same mistake again. But I guess in the heat of the moment, you have to trust yourself, you have to trust your gut and have the belief that what you've done is the right thing to do for the game at that time.
Hmm. You touched on there looking back at your decisions. What is the method of a review or assessment of referees in the A-League?
Yeah, at the moment, there's an assessor live at the ground. There's also a match analyst watching on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got an elite coach who oversees essentially all the coaching of the match officials, as well as a director of referees. So the process is that the assessor live at the ground will debrief after the game in the change room,
mm-hmm.
Usually a short debrief. And then we also complete quite a comprehensive self-assessment that involves obviously looking back at some clips, identifying key match decisions, positives, areas for improvement, and then we'll have our own self-assessment completed along with the match day assessor's assessment report, and then we'll marry them up in a coaching discussion with our elite coach.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, oftentimes you know yourself that if you're honest with yourself, that your self-assessment quite often reflects that of the assessor.
Yeah.
And the elite coach, and that makes the discussion honest, and you're able to learn then from the discussion around how to move forward with the feedback.
Hmm. How much networking have you done with other sports?
Yeah, I've done a lot actually, and I'm quite fortunate. I was part of the National Officiating Scholarship Program, which I know Rugby League and a few of most of the football codes actually have been involved with over the years, and that's actually been invaluable to me in that I could create a network of officials from other codes just to bounce things off, you know, talk things over. We're all dealing with similar challenges quite often in our sports, and so I think that's actually one of the most invaluable tools of how we can learn is just by talking to colleagues from other sports. I mean, and it happens, I guess, in business, you know, borrowing other concepts and implementing them in whatever field that you're in. And so I think it can only be beneficial that we're sharing conversations between sports, and especially the football codes share, you know, quite a lot of similarities.
Hmm. So one of the technologies, I know we touched on the VAR, one of the technologies obviously in rugby league and a few other sports is the wearing of communication gear, not only to communicate amongst officials, but obviously to broadcast. The A-League obviously don't have that. Is there any reason as to why they don't?
Yeah, FIFA don't allow that currently. Mm. They don't allow the broadcast of the communications. And we're bound by what FIFA set down for us as guidelines. I think in the past, potentially the league and Fox Sports have tried to go down that path. And, you know, I guess you're better placed to sort of comment on it, but I would imagine on one hand that it's actually a positive for player behaviour because they know whatever they say is potentially going to be broadcast for the general public. And, you know, for whatever reason, football, you know, has a potential, a bigger issue with dissent and abuse towards match officials than potentially some of the other sports. And that might be one way of, I guess, trying to change the culture around questioning refereeing decisions.
Yeah. And I know that, sorry, it's interesting that you bring that up because I know that speaking to former NRL referees who officiated in a time where that technology wasn't involved said there was the ability to obviously make your own comment back, and obviously we had different character referees then. But, yeah, it's interesting because I was going to raise the point of dissent in football and whether you thought that would possibly bring it down, because I know that in those discussions I have had, that was one of the key parts of reducing player dissent because of the fact it could go to broadcast. Just in relation to the physical side again, how far do you think an A-League referee covers in terms of metres or kilometres in a game?
We're up around the 10 to 12 kilometre mark per match.
Yeah.
With anywhere, probably around a kilometre over 20 k's an hour. So,
yeah.
You know, the game sort of evolved now away from a lot of just constant steady pace aerobic running into more explosive type transition movement, and that's just a factor of, I guess, how the game is played now, that a team can counter-attack from one penalty area to the other and score a goal within 3 or 4 seconds, or there's a potential penalty decision to be made from our point of view. Whilst overall we still need a strong aerobic base, there's certainly a tendency now, and with our training methods, to focus more on repeat sprint ability and certainly explosive dynamic transitions from one end to the other.
Well, thanks for your time. Obviously, you have a big semi-final this weekend with the Brisbane Roar and the Wanderers, so all the best with that. You've been a valuable guest on the View from the Middle podcast.
Thanks, Grant, and well done on this podcast. As I said, I think it's invaluable that match officials are talking to each other from different codes, and we can give a voice, I guess, to a different perspective at elite sport.